talk of revolution. You'd much rather brag. Welcome to Culture Wars Radio on WPRR, 1680 AM and 95.3 FM in Grand Rapids. We've got a great show for you this week. We're going to have the second part of the interview that I did with Dr. Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president. And then we'll be talking to Todd Haywood, a good friend of mine who worked for me at the Michigan Messenger. Todd is one of the best investigative reporters in the country. But first, the man who was recently called a cheerleading sissy by this radio station's favorite pet troll. I haven't even told you about this.
No, you haven't.
No. There's this kid named Chris Staab, or Stab, S-T-A-A-B.
Mm-hmm.
He's a student at Olivet College, and he apparently has a lot of free time and a video camera. And he makes these YouTube videos insulting the hosts on WPRR.
Mm-hmm.
And he started with my friend Jeremiah Bannister, who hosts Paleo Radio on this station, and then he went after Dave Fletcher, who hosts a show and is also the station manager. And then last week he made a video about this show. And one of the things he played a bunch of clips of you laughing at something I said,
mm-hmm.
and called you a cheerleading sissy. I you know, on the radio, of course, you can't tell how anyone looks, but I suspect that if he knew how big you were. What you looked like, that probably wouldn't be his first reaction. I mean, I don't. No one can tell this on the radio, but Don is 6'5" and bald, and generally looks like someone you know whose biker friends could make you disappear.
You want to put us in a room and play a little game of find the bottom?
But to this little sort of quarter-wit dolt, he's a cheerleading sissy.
I hear that. I did a show at Olivet years and years ago and had a blast there.
Yeah, it's a cool little school. And actually,
Jeremiah Bannister was there
as well. The guy that he's that's how this all started was he knows Jeremiah and doesn't like him and yeah. and the videos it's really just audio more than anything else. They're just I mean the guy's got the IQ of a turnip and the charm of an Ebola virus. You know, you listen to it, and you go, what are you eight? What really? You know, like. One of the things that he said was he decided he put up a picture of me and it's like a headshot of me smiling and it says he's probably smiling because he has a banana up his ass. Really? That's it.
Is that your A stuff?
Oh man. So anyway, let's get to the news, which has gotten really weird lately. On Memorial Day, the Miami police had to shoot a guy several times to get him to stop eating the face of another man.
Good Lord.
Who was still alive. And I don't know if you saw David Feldman's. David Feldman's doing these videos for Salon.com now,
mm-hmm.
like commentary on the news. And his one after that, he said, you know, the guy is clearly crazy because everybody knows you can't get fresh face in Florida until at least August. Pure Feldman, right?
That is pure Feldman. That's Feldman distilled.
the essence of Feldman. This guy in this other guy got arrested for eating his roommate's heart and brain. I think that was in Maryland. And then a guy in New York disemboweled himself and threw his own intestines at the police officers.
That's called commitment to a bit.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what that is.
And then I guess in Canada, there's some guy that's sending body parts to politicians in Canada. It's like the Thriller video has come to life or something.
Yes. It's parts of other politicians.
Yeah, no, that would be cool.
That would be sweet. I'd sweep that one under the rug. Yeah. No one's really getting hurt here.
But yeah, it looks like the zombie apocalypse is upon us. So
maybe these people think that they're afraid that it's upon us. They think, well, maybe I should try this and see if so I can leave instructions. Nah, don't like brain. Just kill me now. I'll be around eternity. I decided, like, it's not for me. I read the brochures. I had some brain. I'm going to opt out of the whole zombie afterlife thing.
There's a meme going around Facebook of somebody put up a picture of a head Jeffrey Dahmer, and it says, I ate people before it was cool. A hipster Jeffrey Dahmer. But just remember, if you're confronted, aim for the head. Very, very important. Aim for that.
Very important.
So I want to talk about science a bit this week. There's a new Gallup poll out. Gallup has been doing a survey on this for 30 years now about Americans' belief in evolution. And the new poll for this year out says that 46% of Americans think that God created human beings in their present form in the last 10,000 years. 32% say humans evolved, but with sort of a divine assist from God. And 15% think humans evolved over millions of years on their own. And those numbers are remarkably consistent over the last 30 years, which just makes me wonder, like, how do they explain the fossils at all? Like, we have this remarkable series of species in fossil form that show the evolution of humans in pretty much every trait that matters: brain to body size ratio, the ability to walk upright, changes in teeth and skeletal structure, and so forth. And they appear in exactly the right order, so you can sort of watch these traits as they evolved over the, you know, over the course of millions of years. From the Australopithecines to Homo habilis to Homo erectus to Cro-Magnon man and Neanderthals and so forth. Was God practicing? Is that, I mean, was he like making a bunch of prototypes, like some almost humans and then some almost humans and then, I mean, it just seems awfully odd for an omnipotent God.
Yeah.
You know.
And then that whole concept of the thing I always find enjoyable is that this was put here to test you.
Yeah, I've heard a few people.
I've heard that, and I'm thinking, I think an omnipotent being would have better things to do than play two for flinching with you.
Well, that was the old Bill Hicks line about the guy saying, God put those fossils here to test my faith. And he says, dude, I think he put you here to test my faith. But, you know, the thing is, I mean, the overwhelming majority of Americans know as little about biology as they know about, you know, Bulgarian folk music. And I would bet that less than 5% of Americans even know that those other species that I mentioned existed at all. They base their opinions on complete ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
But there are two kinds of ignorance at work here. And I gave a speech a few years ago that aired on C-SPAN, and I talked about the difference between what I called mundane ignorance and virulent ignorance. And the difference is that mundane ignorance is just, we are all ignorant of more subjects than we're knowledgeable about. And that's true of all of us. You know, there are thousands of subjects that if you ask me about them, you know, the answer, you ask me what I know about them, the answer would be, you know, pretty much nothing. And that's just perfectly normal. Virulent ignorance, on the other hand, is something different. A person has virulent ignorance when they think they know something about a subject because they've accepted a whole bunch of falsehoods about it, and they don't know that they're false. And in my experience, nowhere is this more prevalent than on the subject of evolution. You know, very, very few people have done any serious study of evolution and the evidence for it, and yet everyone has an opinion on it.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone thinks they know enough about it to have a strong opinion on it. And there's this huge list of lies and myths that are passed on that give people the illusion of understanding. Like when you hear someone say that evolution violates the second law of thermodynamics, well, that's a completely absurd claim. But a huge number of people believe it because their pastor told them it's true, or some, you know, Christian apologetics book that they read said it's true. When someone asked, if humans evolved, why are there from apes, why are there still apes? You know beyond a shadow of a doubt that this person doesn't know anything about how evolution works, yet they have formed a very strong opinion on the subject based on those kinds of ridiculous questions. And, you know, many of the fossils that I mentioned were found by the Leakey family, Lewis and Mary Leakey, and now their son Richard, and now his children are paleontologists as well. And Richard Leakey wrote an article recently in which he said that within the next, he said 15 to 30 years, skepticism over evolution will go away because of new scientific discoveries. And I just thought that's ridiculous. He's being incredibly naive here.
Mm-hmm.
If evidence convinced the majority of people, there would be no doubt about evolution now.
Exactly.
You know, the science has been undeniable for more than a century now. But evidence has almost nothing to do with whether people accept evolution, because the overwhelming majority of people don't know anything about the evidence. You know, they care more about who Kim Kardashian is sleeping with than they do about science. And I'd be okay with that, or more okay with that, if they would stop pretending to know something. You know, I mean, if this
feel more naked about it, I don't know. Here's what I've been told.
Exactly. If there was intellectual honesty, 90% of the people would respond to that poll by saying, I don't know, because they, in fact, don't know. But they think they do. They pretend to. And they have this very strongly held opinion based on nothing but essentially group identification. You know, they identify with their religion. Their religion says evolution is wrong, therefore evolution must be wrong. You know, I think that's basically the thinking that goes into it. And you know, I think part of the problem here is that we run our schools through elected school boards, and most of the people who are elected to them are themselves very ignorant. And I've proposed before a rule that says no one should be allowed to vote in the curriculum for a given subject if they can't pass the AP exam on that subject.
Excellent idea.
Yeah. I mean, we don't put bakers or accountants in charge of NASA. It wouldn't even occur to you. And yet we put, you know, real estate agents who've never studied anything except real estate on school boards and let them vote on curriculum. It's just baffling to me that why we do this. You wouldn't put me on the board of a cosmetology school to, you know, I certainly hope you wouldn't, you know, and yet we would put a cosmetologist who, you know, doesn't know anything about this on a school board and let them vote. So anyway, let's take a break there. We need to be back. We will be back with more in the second hour with Don Reese. And we are back with Dr. Jill Stein, who is certainly going to be the nominee for president for the Green Party. You beat out Roseanne Barr for that, right? Which seems kind of odd to me.
Yes, yes. It certainly looks like the Green Party wants to have a, what shall we say, a voice of credibility and pragmatic solutions and experience. I think the Green Party is really looking to bring real solutions to the table and drive them forward. We are prepared to govern. We are governing in lots of local offices around the country, and we're prepared to bring that experience. And, you know, I certainly value Roseanne Barr's contribution here. But shall we say, Roseanne is not pretending to be a voice of experience or grassroots solutions. And I think the party has made clear that it really wants to put a pragmatic choice forward here. The goal is to govern more than to entertain, I think.
Yeah. I have something of a history with Roseanne Barr, which I won't go into here. But I used to do stand-up comedy, actually.
Oh, no kidding.
For several years. And so there's pretty funny stories there, but I won't tell them here.
I can imagine.
But you know, one of the things I mentioned in the first hour of our interview, that I write a lot about criminal justice issues and civil mm-hmm. liberties issues, and I gave a big talk on that subject last night. I don't know if you're familiar with Michelle Alexander's book.
Oh yes,
The Jim Crow.
Yes.
Amazing book, and I've had her on the show.
Oh great.
And that book, the statistics in that book, and I talked mm-hmm. about this in my speech last night. Even as someone who's written for years about these subjects, some of the statistics are so astonishing that they shock the conscience when it comes to mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. racial aspects. In particular, and she cited all of these studies that show that, you know, in New Jersey, for example, even though 15% of the people traveling down the New Jersey Turnpike were black, you know, that something like 70% of the people who were pulled over and searched were black, even though the same study also found that white people were actually more likely to be found with contraband, you know, illegal drugs or whatever in the car than black people. We heard this in the recent report that came out about New York and the NYPD and their mm-hmm. stop and frisk mm-hmm. program. Mm-hmm. 700,000 people stopped and frisked last year. Mm-hmm. 87% of them were black or Latino.
Mm-hmm.
These things just shock the conscience. And, you know, what would you do to fix that system?
Well, for starters, you know, I think these unconstitutional search programs need to be called to a screeching halt, you know, including stop and frisk, as well as the president's so-called secure communities program, which is basically another racial profiling, in this case, deportation program. So the programs that are systematically violating our civil liberties need to be called out as such and stopped. But going beyond that, you know, I think there are several problems which converge here. You know, one is the violation of our civil liberties, and the other one is the whole war on drugs. And
absolutely, I'm
the war
so
on drugs
to
needs to be
that.
Called to a halt,
yeah.
Because it is it's getting us into deeper and deeper trouble all the time. Not only is it not working, it is, you know, it's a very active pathology in and of itself. And, you know, so for starters, on day one as president, what a president could do is instruct the Food and Drug Administration to actually use science in the determination of scheduling of various substances. So if science were brought to bear, marijuana and hemp, for that matter, would not be scheduled substances because they are far less harmful than tobacco and alcohol by a long shot. So by legalizing marijuana, you also, you know, you sort of call an end to the whole war on drugs, because it's marijuana money which funds the rest of the illegal drug trade as well. Marijuana is the workhorse for the entire underground drug economy. So,
but I think we need to just legalize it all. I think it's not just marijuana, although clearly that's where public opinion is going. I think we now have, I saw a poll the other day, like 57% supporting legalizing marijuana specifically, and we're probably going to have to do it in stages. But ultimately, I think we just need to end the entire war on drugs, not just marijuana. We need to treat it as
absolutely.
A public health problem,
that's
not
right.
a criminality problem.
That's right. And you don't even need to accomplish legalization in order to do that. You know, I think what you can do from the get-go is start treating these problems as mental health and public health problems. And instead of incarceration, you sentence people to rehabilitation. You know, and treatment, and you also engage prevention on the ground. And how do you prevent? You prevent by basically, we need a war on poverty, not a war on drugs. And that war on poverty is very much what our Green New Deal is about. And I do see that as a comprehensive solution to so many of these problems, that if we begin to put people to work, then the poverty that drives people to actual drug abuse and drug dependence gets taken care of. But recreational use of marijuana is not a problem, you know, and we need to stop calling it a problem. And marijuana needs to be defined according to its science, and the science would not uphold the scheduling, you know, the placing of marijuana on Schedule 1 or whatever it is that makes it this very dangerous illegal drug.
Yeah, it is Schedule 1, and you're right. This is something that very few people realize. The Controlled Substances Act specifically gives the executive branch the power to change that schedule.
Yes,
they
that's
could.
Right.
There is a whole procedure in place where the Department of Justice and the Department of Health and Human Services can make what they call a legal finding,
mm-hmm.
and demote marijuana from a Schedule 1 drug down to a Schedule 2 or 3 drug. And that alone would be a major step in the right direction. But here again, Obama has been a disaster. Despite his promises to stop, during the campaign, to stop the DEA from going after medical marijuana users in states where medical marijuana use is perfectly legal, he has ramped it up. It's gotten worse.
Oh, yeah. It's terrible. I mean, it's just unbelievable to see these reports and to see the photographs of police in full riot gear outside the homes of cerebral palsy patients in wheelchairs. You know, that these patients who are legally using drugs for which they have prescriptions are being criminalized. It's just staggering.
Yeah, and that's
the
real enemy,
this.
Right? That's the problem. We got to stop those people with cancer from people going
right,
through chemo. We got to stop them from
treating their pain. Yes, or their nausea. Yeah. They're using an important medication here for an entirely legal, needed purpose. It's just, to me, it's become emblematic of this president's, turnaround, because there's almost nothing he hasn't turned around on. Now, he hasn't turned around to be quite head for head, with the Republicans in some ways. Your point earlier about, the parties are not the same. That's true. But they are both, I see them in my mind, they're both sinking ships. One may be sinking faster than the other, but the solution when you're on a sinking ship is not to just get off onto another ship, which is also sinking, but not quite as quickly. That's why I think it's so important to really encourage people to replace the politics of fear right now with the politics of courage and actually stand up for real solutions here, not just the less lethal or the more slowly lethal game plan here. We really need to get on board with the politics of courage and start standing up for ourselves.
I don't know if you saw Penn Jillette from Penn and Teller on a radio show the other day, just went into what was really sort of a righteous rant on this subject of drug legalization and Obama. And Penn Jillette is a guy, and I've met Penn. In fact, I'm going to see him here in a couple of weeks. A group that I'm on the board of is bringing him in to Michigan. But this is a guy who has never used drugs and has never had a drop of alcohol. He will not even allow alcohol in his home. This is a guy who's a straight arrow when it comes to this stuff. But he said, look, it doesn't matter what I want to do. And he made what I thought was a really compelling point about this. That he said, look, Obama has admitted to smoking pot and doing cocaine as a young man. In his book, Dreams of My Father, he admitted that.
Mm-hmm.
He said, is there anyone who thinks that either he or the country would have been better off if he had been caught and sent to prison? Because that's what would have happened.
Yeah.
Is there anybody who actually can argue that that would have been better for his life?
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't be president. He would never have been the success that he is now. He would have been cut off from Pell Grants for college. He would have been kept out of, eliminated from all public assistance. He would have lost his right to vote for at least a period of time. Essentially, his career would have been over.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody would look at that and go, wow, he's right. There's certainly, that would have been a terrible thing for him and his family and all of that. He probably would never have even met Michelle. He probably would never have, had these wonderful children and so forth. But that's not just about him. That's true of every person. And we're talking about 750,000 people every year get arrested for marijuana alone. Yeah, I think that point is so compelling. Yes, drugs do bad things to people's lives. That's absolutely true. I don't think marijuana does for the most part, but certainly the harder drugs can screw up people's lives. I have friends who would probably be dead if they had continued doing drugs.
Sure.
But would putting them in prison improve that in any way at all? No.
Exactly. For the most part, it just turns people into hardened criminals and makes it impossible for them to support themselves and outside of the underground drug economy. So it's extremely counterproductive. And add to that, the fact that what's really dangerous about marijuana is the violence that surrounds it. So, in fact, marijuana is a substance which is dangerous because it's illegal. It's not illegal because it's dangerous.
And that's not just true of marijuana. I mean, almost every problem that we think is part of the drug problem is really brought on by drug prohibition, not the drugs themselves. That doesn't mean that using drugs is good. But most of the problems that we look at, gang violence and so forth, you don't see Seagram's and Budweiser having turf wars. And hiring gangs to shoot one another up over turf, over territory, because they're legal corporations, regulated and licensed, and that's the way it should be. And I don't know how exactly to design the system. I don't think I would just say, okay, everything's legal, do whatever you want. I think for the harder drugs, you'd have to put together some sort of system for prescriptions or, medical supervision or, there are ways, various sort of, proposals for how you would make that system. But I do know that the system we have now clearly isn't working, and it's creating the problems that it claims to solve.
And it's not hard to see how to go the first step. It may be hard to envision how we get from A to Z here, but we know a first gigantic leap forward that we can take, which is by essentially legalizing marijuana.
Yeah.
And that can happen, pretty quickly and pretty easily, and then we can begin to change the framework for drug policy from being one of criminal enforcement to a public health framework. And, you know, I think let's just go step one here and then reevaluate and see where we go from there. But it will be an enormous boon to, you know, as you say, 750,000 people a year. We can get a lot of people out of jail and into rehab instead, save a huge amount of public money.
Especially at the state and local level, where it really is. I mean, in Michigan, we spend $2 billion a year on our prison
mm-hmm.
system.
Yeah. So
that's a huge chunk of our budget.
It sure is.
And I think it was a good way to put it. That, yeah, A to Z is a big leap, but we know how to get from A to B. Let's at least do that.
Let's do that. That's right. And that will provide such a world of good that it's going to be much easier to get from B to C once we've gotten from A to B.
But this whole criminal justice system, I mean, I think Michelle Alexander's book demonstrates so perfectly, and this is the way I put it in my talk last night, is that you add all these things up, all these problems up in our criminal justice system, and what you have is – whether it was intentionally designed that way or not, you have a system mm-hmm. that is very well designed, intentionally or otherwise, for creating a permanent underclass.
Oh, yeah.
A permanent underclass that is predominantly Black and Latino rather than mm-hmm. white. 70% of all people in a criminal justice system, and we're talking about 7 million people now who are either mm-hmm. in prison or on probation or parole. 70% of them are minorities.
Mm-hmm.
And once they get into the system, they are essentially their chances of improving their life are for all practical purposes over.
Mm-hmm.
You are no longer eligible to get a Pell Grant. You're no longer eligible for food stamps or public housing assistance in most
mm-hmm.
states. And here again, we keep going back to this with the two parties. That stuff was signed into law by Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, it's not an either or, and mm-hmm. you know the asset forfeiture laws were written by Joe Biden, and
mm.
so you know the this isn't one party. One party may be a little better than mm-hmm. the other, but they are both screwing it up in a big way. So let's talk about foreign policy.
Great.
Shifting gears here for a moment. Republicans and Democrats alike seem to love sending American troops overseas for all sorts of military adventures. We essentially have a bipartisan consensus in favor of the neoconservative foreign policy vision of Bill Kristol now,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
has not worked out very well, I don't think. If you were president, how would you handle problems abroad?
I would resort to these rarely used strategies called human rights and international law. They should be really the overarching guidelines of our foreign policy. And as a third fundamental here, we need, through the Green New Deal, to meet our energy needs here at home through conservation and renewable energy. And that removes the incentive, which is enormous, to be fighting wars in battlefields that deliver oil or precious minerals and scarce resources that we need, you know, supposedly, it's really our fossil fuel industry needs in order to maintain its profits. Likewise, you know, there's the kind of corporate pressure to be extending markets and to kind of capture markets that appears to be a driver of this military adventurism as well. So, you know, we, through the Green New Deal, we intend to have a relocalized, just, humane, and sustainable economy here at home, one that is not creating pressure for military conquests and empire building abroad. We've been spending, you know, it's estimated to be somewhere between $4 and $5 trillion over the past decade on these wars for oil in Iraq and Afghanistan. And exactly where did that get us? You know, when we had to withdraw from Iraq in the dead of night on a secret date that no one knew about for fear that we would be ambushed as we left. So how much of a victory here did we actually accomplish in a country that remains on the verge of civil war? Same goes in Afghanistan. You know, what makes anybody think that the Afghani, the current Afghani forces, who've not been able to hold their own when the U.S. really hasn't, or NATO has not been able to make progress in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is essentially a stalemate, despite all the money we've spent on it. You know, how exactly are we turning that over now to local forces? We're going to have, it's estimated, some 16,000 special ops on site there and other security forces, but that we're supposedly training the Afghani army, who's suddenly miraculously going to be able to accomplish what NATO could not. You know, this is all just really smoke and mirrors for a retreat, and it's been incredibly costly to American lives, to American taxpayers, to Afghani and Iraqi lives, and to U.S., you know, just the image of the United States as an international player. It's been extremely costly to us, and there's been no better recruiting agent for, you know, for so-called forces of terrorism than for us to be, you know, to have committed the war crimes and the incredible civilian hardships and the massacres and so on that just routinely take place in the theater of war. So all of this doesn't work, and we, under a Stein or a Green administration, we would be greening our foreign policy and basically working with diplomacy, working through a budget that actually supports indigenous development and supports local players to do their own, you know, economic development, and not to co-opt markets and resources for the U.S. through our foreign policy.
You know, you didn't mention Libya in there, and that's another, again,
yes.
We keep coming back to this theme, but here's another place where Republicans and Democrats aren't any different on this stuff. What
That's
President
right.
Obama did in Libya was clearly illegal and unconstitutional.
That's right.
But Congress has essentially given up its constitutionally defined role. And we haven't declared war since World War II. Yet we've been in a whole bunch of wars since World War II. And Congress has essentially washed their hands of this and said, look, and I think for political reasons, look, Americans love war. Every time we go to war, there's, you know, you look at the polls and there's 70 or 80% approval for it initially. As long as we get a quick, clean victory and we don't lose too many people, you know, then everybody's fine with it. In almost all, not everybody, but, you know, the majority of Americans, I think, are fine with it. And I think Congress is, they don't want to ever seem like they're against a war starting because of that. They know how public opinion does. We nationalism just automatically kicks in, you know, in cases like that. So they have essentially outsourced the power to declare war to the president now, despite the War Powers Act and all of that. And you know, so, you know, here we have Obama goes and, you know, starts bombing Libya with no congressional authorization whatsoever, without even attempting to ask Congress if he thought it was a good idea. That's the sort of thing that we need, you know, sort of systematically to enforce the Constitution, right?
Right. And, in fact, you have Panetta going to Congress and telling Congress, in fact, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, telling them that he, Panetta, and the Department of Defense do not need congressional authorization for Syria in this case because they have NATO. You know, so there's been an incredible end run here around the constitutional authority of Congress, and really not only authority but responsibility to oversee, you know, military adventures and misadventures. So this system has all, you know, there are many ways that an end run is being committed around, you know, the normal checks and balances that should be safeguarding Americans against foreign entanglements without there being a true national security risk. And there has not been a true national security risk, certainly in any of these recent conflicts.
Since World War II. I mean, I can't think of a war
right.
that was justified since World War II. I mean, okay, maybe Afghanistan. You had to go in, I think, you had to go in after Al-Qaeda one way or the other. I guess I can understand the argument there. But that didn't necessitate invading Afghanistan necessarily.
That's right. And it also, that bought the president some time, but that didn't excuse the Congress forever from weighing in at some point as to whether or not this was, you know, a legal
war. Well, and there is
war.
An authorization to use military force. It just isn't a declared war. I mean, at least in Afghanistan, Congress did say, yes, we agree that you can do this. In Libya, there wasn't even an attempt. Congress didn't even want to talk about it. Harry Reid wouldn't even schedule a debate. Schedule a floor, you know, conversation about it.
What I think the Congress has done on war, you know, has basically happened in virtually every area of foreign policy, which is that the argument has been surrendered to the prevailing special interest. You know, in this case, the military-industrial complex, which is vast and massive and has its tentacles all over Congress. But Congress has done the same thing on health care, where it has basically ceded to the health insurance industry, which wrote the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare, on oil and nuclear power. I mean, Congress has basically become a rubber stamp for the powers of corporate America. And when
it's a subsidiary, basically.
Exactly, yes, fully. And to my mind, so this is a generic question, you know, about how do we get ourselves out of this quagmire? How do we recapture the power of our democracy? And, you know, this is a kind of a catch-22, how you ever do it when you're trapped in this problem. But, you know, one thing that an executive can do, whether it's the president or the governor of a state or the mayor of a town or a city, you know, and let's focus on the president for the moment, since that's in the target hairs right now. You know, the president has the power to inform and empower ordinary citizens to be drivers of our democracy, as they should be. So the president could not only be the commander-in-chief, the president could be the organizer-in-chief. The president has the power to clue people in. Hey, there's a vote coming up on Medicare for All. And what you need to know about it is that it will save us trillions of dollars over the next decade. It puts you in charge of picking your provider and deciding your healthcare decisions for a change instead of an insurance bureaucrat. And that it covers you, all of you, and all parts of you. So everybody's covered comprehensively, chronic care as well as acute. It covers your pharmaceuticals, your mental health, your reproductive health care, your eyes, your hearing aid, you know, all those things that always get left out, your mental health, complete coverage at a bargain basement price. You have everything to gain and nothing to lose. Call your congressmen and women and your senator now. President could actually do that with emails, with public service announcement time, by going on primetime TV. The president can mobilize the public opinion, which already is clamoring for this solution, which already has large majorities in poll after poll. The president could actually mobilize that public momentum and ensure that we pass Medicare for All. The president could do the same thing to downsize the military and bring the troops home. The president can do that, and in fact, there is public support. Even though Congress doesn't support it, Congress would be the last ones to come around. The president could actually engage people to call their congressmen and women and do like was done with the SOCA bill, where the public got alerted to what was going on through no help from Congress or the big corporate media. The public learned that the internet was at risk for being censored and got the word out, and that bill was stopped on a dime. But it's very hard for the public to mobilize itself. We don't have, you know, adequate public records or open meeting laws. And the press, you know, for the most part, with present company and a few others excluded, the press is completely asleep at the wheel. You know, so we are flying blind on the issue of public policy. But if the president was actually informing people about what was coming up, when it was coming up, and here are the three talking points to take to your senator and your congressmen and women, we'd suddenly see, you know, that democracy could begin to kick in. And we could turn this system around one bill at a time, including reforms that would change the structure, that would get at the fundamental, hijacking, straitjacketing, you know, of our democracy, so that the system would begin to work.
You mentioned downsizing the military, and Leon Panetta has been, I wrote a column about this a few months ago, where I said, with Democrats like this, who needs Republicans?
Yeah.
Leon Panetta has been, for months now, throwing a temper tantrum about even the most tiny cuts to defense spending. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about $50 billion a year out of almost $600 billion. We spend 48% of all military spending in the entire world is by the United States, more than the next 10 countries combined.
Exactly.
The cuts that are being discussed with the sequestration is $500 billion over 10 years. Mm. That's $50 billion a year. That'll reduce us from 48% of the world's spending to about 46.5%.
Yeah, exactly.
And yet we have Panetta going in front of Congress and going on TV and saying, these are dangerous cuts. We're putting our national security at risk. And I'm thinking, what universe do you live in? Well, he lives in a universe where he is essentially, his job is to defend the military-industrial complex and the defense contractors.
Exactly.
And keep their profits for it.
As is the job of the Democratic Party, as well as the Republican Party. So, yes, this is why we need a broader system solution, and why, again, I want to remind people to go to my website, jillstein.org, and be part of the solution. Don't go in there and give them a mandate for four more years of the same. We can meet the politics of fear with the politics of courage. On this point about military expenditures, we are now spending six times more than the next biggest spender, that's China. What that means is we can cut military expenditures in half, and we'll still be outspending China by a factor of three, spending three times more than China. So it's just nuts to think that we attain security spending $1 trillion a year, which is what we spend on the combined military-industrial security complex. Our expenditures were basically doubled after 9/11, and you'd be hard-pressed to show evidence that these expenditures have actually made us more secure, because while you are, you know, while you're bombing schools and hospitals and homes around the world, you are recruiting the next terrorist, as so-called terrorist, as quickly as you have eliminated the last one. In fact, you're proliferating them. So this is not the way to peace and security. We'll get to peace and security by respecting international law and human rights, and by establishing peace and security on our own streets here, you know, in the USA, by providing jobs, eliminating poverty, implementing the Green New Deal, providing public higher education as a public good, which is tuition free, forgiving student debt, and putting an end to the home foreclosure crisis. All of this can be done in a way that actually saves us money. It doesn't cost us money.
I have long thought that FDR's most famous quote, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," should really be rewritten. It should be, "The only thing we have to sell is fear itself," because that is what we hear from both major parties constantly. It's all about fear. It's about fear of Muslims coming here and taking over the country. That one cracks me up. Look, I am an atheist, pro-gay rights, all of that. I'm the last person who wants bin Laden's ideology implemented anywhere. I think it's incredibly barbaric. But the notion that Muslims, and this is a very sort of right-wing stance, the notion that Muslims are on the verge of taking over the country and implementing Sharia law, again, I just wonder, what planet do these people live on? I worry more about, I joked once that, a Muslim takeover of America, for me, ranks, sort of somewhere between a zombie apocalypse and a Backstreet Boys reunion. In terms of, what I wait, stay up at night worrying about,
it's shameful. It is demagoguery, and I think it really plays on, in the same way that the FBI, goes out there and entraps very marginal people, you know, into plotting terrible things that they wouldn't do if the FBI weren't entrapping them. You know, the demagogues are doing the same thing, and they're playing on the incredible insecurities and despair and outright, you know, mental illness that's out there, and putting really crazy ideas into people's heads. And it's extremely irresponsible of politicians, political parties, and corporate media, I think, to be playing on these fears and, you know, really exploiting them for their own, you know, profit and personal benefit. But, you know, when I first began to run for office back in 2002 as a really frustrated community advocate who had really done everything I saw possible short of entering the political fray, and only saw us going backwards on, you know, on jobs, on healthcare, on the environment and the poisoning really of our children through pollution and its concentration in the food supply and all the rest. You know, I had spent years going through all the legitimate channels and basically just saw us backsliding. You know, I went into the political fray, having been recruited to run for governor by the Green Party, and I went into that fray thinking, oh, these ideas of justice and community health and things like that, oh, the public would never be interested in that because the public is, you know, interested in these crazy things and you know, the celebrity girlfriends and, you know, nothing more substantive than that. And that's what the media wants you to think. But what I discovered was, oh my God, the real world of politics was something totally different from these boxes of Democrats and Republicans that most people, except those who are on the payroll, really don't see themselves as pigeonholed into that at all. Most people, even back in 2002, really understood that the political system was a trap, that it was manipulative, that it was extremely self-serving by greedy politicians who were looking to basically make a buck and create economic opportunities for themselves at the end of the day. They were looking to become lobbyists. When they cycled out of being politicians, they would then become a very well-paid lobbyist. You know, that was the way the system worked, and most people get that, and people were absolutely starving for a real politics of integrity that's of, by, and for the people. When I got into the debates, the gubernatorial debates, back in 2002, I was being voted winner on the instant online viewer polls. I was totally flabbergasted to see that the public actually agreed with just sort of plain common sense public interest ideas. This was even back in 2002, before the crisis had really taken full hold like it has now. And so, you know, when I hear the press ballyhooing, you know, all these fear-mongering, you know, demons out there, you know, I kind of take it with a grain of salt, because this is exactly, the press wants us to be afraid of our own shadow. They really want us to be afraid that the public has been totally taken over the, you know, the edge of the loony bin. But I think there are some, that's for sure. There is a lunatic fringe, and it can be, you know, substantial numbers of people, but it's definitely not the majority of people. The majority of people really are still very, you know, common sense, common purpose, public interest. They're really looking for a politics of integrity that doesn't look and smell like a rat. So, you know, I think what happened in Tahrir Square and Tunisia should not be ruled out, and that it's really important for us to push the envelope as hard and fast as we can, because the, you know, the noose is closing in, whether it's these skyrocketing rates of poverty, whether it's the next run on the European banks, which could be happening, you know, this week for all we know, you know, and the next crash of our Wall Street banks that have not yet, you know, been fixed and are still too big to fail, that could just plunge us into the next Great Depression whole hog, you know, the climate crisis, which on which we are teetering on the brink right now. You know, these need immediate solutions. Fortunately, those solutions are in hand. They are not rocket science, And when they say there's not enough money, they mean there's not enough money for you. For us, there's plenty of money. Instead of wars, Wall Street, and tax breaks for the wealthy, we can use our resources for a Green New Deal, making public higher education free, providing health care as a human right, and in fact that pays for itself. It doesn't cost us anything. It saves us trillions of dollars. Downsizing the military, bailing out the students, and putting an immediate moratorium on home foreclosures. We can fix this. We can also break up the banks that are too big to fail and create state banks that will actually provide the money to small businesses and families and states and cities for doing the things that we need to do. The money is there. The solutions are well tested. We can put them to work right now, and we have every reason to stand up to not only occupy the banks and the streets, but to occupy the voting booth and to actually move forward the real solutions that will solve our problems and get us back on track to the secure green future that we deserve.
I'll be honest with you, I'm a lot more cynical than you are. I don't know that we're really going to fix these things. And I teeter back and forth because I'm an activist, you know? And I stay active even though I don't really think it's going to change much. Although I think over the long haul, I mean, I guess I've always just had a long-term focus on it, which is why I've always voted third party rather than for the two major parties. It's not because I think, you know, the third party is going to win this year, but because I think over the long haul we sort of build, memes and ideas. And that's, I think, the only way to change a lot of this, but the Occupy movement gives me a little bit of hope. I think people are starting to get more involved. I wish it were more organized. I wish it were more professional. And unfortunately, we get into this a lot with any kind of protest, is that I've seen this happen at sort of local and state events. Whenever the anarchists show up, you got problems. And they taint everything else. And I think you're seeing some of that going on in Chicago now. You see it every time.
And it's hard to know which is actually anarchist black bloc and which is, undercover agents.
A false flag.
It's very hard to know. And this is why, I think it is so important that there be an associated process. And this is what history actually tells us, is that usually social movements also have an independent political voice, which has more of a process that ensures it not get co-opted by the undercover agents, etc., that actually has a broad process which is democratically protected, and which can then articulate specific solutions and specific policies and drive them into the public process. That's why I think it's critical. But I shared your cynicism. I totally shared your cynicism. And I entered the political process only out of desperation. You know, because I'm a mother. I don't know if you're a parent, but, as parents, we don't give up. And, when you're ready to throw in the towel, you don't throw in the towel. You do the next thing that you haven't tried yet. And for me, that was engaging the political process. And I had never been a member of a political party, let alone run for office. And I was blown away that these ideas that you and I are talking about as common sense is actually what the public put its stamp of approval on when it actually had the chance. And let me give you one other thing that totally knocked my socks off and put me on the, in this path of, I'd call it not optimism, I'd call it just plain old empowerment. We ran a referendum here in Massachusetts, which was basically like the Green New Deal. It said, instead of providing billions of dollars a year, which is what we provide at the state level, it's much bigger at the national level, but we asked the question here at the state level, instead of providing billions a year in tax breaks for corporations that are fossil fuel and nuclear based, instead we provide grants, subsidies, startup money for small businesses and worker cooperatives at the community level. So these are community-based small businesses in the green economy that are creating jobs in the areas of clean renewable energy, conservation, local healthy food systems, bike paths, etc. how about we do that instead? Let's just redefine economic development here. Let's just shift the money, make it local, small scale, and green. We did not have money to put into this referendum, so we were hoping maybe we would get 10 or 15%. And we got it on the ballot in like 26 cities and towns, something like that. We were completely flabbergasted. We got between 75 and 95% in every community, including those that were post-industrial, impoverished urban communities that weren't green in the least. Given the option, people actually wanted to do the right thing, not just for jobs, but also for the environment, for health, for their communities. People didn't need to be educated. They already got it. It's just the media that creates this nonsense that people don't get it. People largely do get it, with the exception of those who are on the payroll and then a small lunatic fringe. Most people get what's going on here and will support solutions when they can tell that it doesn't look like a rat, talk like a rat, or smell like a rat. Out on the campaign trail, we have found we get a lot of support from Tea Party people, as well as from Right to Lifers, if I can bring that in as well, who get that, yeah, we differ on some things, but on just sort of basics, who is trying to exploit you politically, and who's really being honest and talking about basic values of honesty, liberty, civil liberties, democracy. A whole lot of people are ready to stand up and shout on this, that the media would like you to think don't get it at all. In fact, they do get it.
Well, I certainly hope you're right. it's always a struggle for me not to become too cynical. I often quote Molly Ivins, who famously said, no matter how cynical I am, I can't keep up. Jill, thank you so much for being with us, and I'm glad you had time to stick around for the second hour. This has been an amazing conversation.
It really has.
And I really enjoyed it, and maybe we'll have you back on the show sometime.
And I hate to say it, but you've lifted my optimism yet another notch to see that there is such an amazing resource out there that is, that is informing and empowering the broader community. So thank you so much for being the kind of real press that we need. Keep up your good work.
I'm not actually a journalist anymore, although I suppose this show could be considered that in some way. But even in conservative West Michigan, in Grand Rapids, WPRR does a pretty good job of covering these issues. So
that's awesome.
Thank you so much for being here.
Great. Thank you, Ed. Great talking with you.
Right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
My next guest is Todd Haywood. Todd is one of my good friends and a former colleague. I had the good fortune of being his editor at the Michigan Messenger for the past few years, where he did really exceptional work as an investigative reporter. He continues to do that for the American Independent News Network, AmericanIndependent.com. Todd, welcome to Culture Wars Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Ed.
So you did really great work covering the oil spill in Calhoun County a couple of years ago, and there continues to be new stories coming out of that situation, and your reporting recently led to criminal indictments, I hear. So tell my listeners how that sort of came about.
Sure. As you know, back in 2010, after the oil spill happened, about a month into the cleanup operation, we received an anonymous tip at Michigan Messenger that there were undocumented workers being exploited on the river in unsafe conditions. And so I went down and rallied with the workers before they went out, talked to a bunch of them, and they did indeed acknowledge that they were undocumented and that they were here illegally in the country. And we published that story at the end of August, and by the second day of September, the company that had brought them up had been fired from the oil spill and was actually caught offloading the undocumented workers in a town in Texas called Winnie, Texas. And as a result, in February, the owner of that company and one of the managers were indicted by a federal grand jury on multiple counts of immigration conspiracy violations.
And to me, the important part of the story wasn't so much the undocumented workers. It was how they were being mistreated and forced to work in unsafe conditions. I mean, you actually went down there and sort of went in there undercover and got a ton of pictures of what were really very unsafe conditions, right?
Correct. The EPA and the Enbridge officials actually acknowledged when they were shown these photos, which, to correct you a little bit, were actually taken by our anonymous source on the river.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
We would never have been able to get in there. But the pictures clearly documented safety violations, such as these workers were being forced to eat their food in the middle of the cleanup. They were covered in oil. Their hands were covered with crude oil. And, you know, this was tar sands oil, so it wasn't just oil. It was toxic stuff with mercury and nickel and cadmium and all kinds of heavy metals in it that these folks were being forced to consume because they weren't being allowed to go anywhere where they could clean up.
Yeah, and they were forced to work in, what, 12, 14-hour days, 7 days a week.
Correct. And their pay was $800 a week plus a hotel room, and they were fed fast food. So, you know, this was not a great deal for anybody that was involved except for the Hallmark Industrial, which had brought them up. They were obviously making money off of this, which, according to the indictment, was actually part of their conspiracy.
Sure, sure. You know, you mentioned the fact that this is tar sands oil, and maybe we should give a little background here for those who, as the story's been a couple of years ago. In July 2010, an underground pipeline burst near Marshall, Michigan, and it sent almost 1 million gallons of oil into the Kalamazoo River. That pipeline was owned by Enbridge, a Canadian company. It was carrying tar sands crude oil from Alberta, Canada, which is the same oil that would go to Texas in the controversial Keystone XL pipeline that's gotten so much attention over the last few months when that pipeline is approved. And I say when because it's going to get approved. And anybody who thinks otherwise is sort of kidding themselves. But the spill in Michigan, I think, really kind of highlights a lot of the dangers of expanding our import of tar sands crude, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, you know, the EPA said a year ago at the one-year anniversary of the rupture that they literally had to write the book on how to clean up tar sands oil. Well, they were cleaning up tar sands oil in the Kalamazoo River because it was the first time that they'd ever had to do that. And because this oil is different than traditional sweet crude oil, it interacts with the environment very differently. In this instance, they found that it's separated from the lighter crude oil that was used to thin it out. And the heavier tar sands oil actually sunk to the bottom of the river. And there's about 22 acres on the bottom of the Kalamazoo River of thick tar soil, oil and soil, that they're trying to get out of the river still. And that is leaching out heavy metals. And as you know, the EPA and officials in the cleanup had not even begun testing for those heavy metals until we said, hey, this oil is contaminated with these heavy metals. Are you testing for them? And then they began testing for them and started going, oh, wait, yes, those are in the water here. What's going on? So this has really shown, I think, not only the public, but to the government officials and regulators, the tar sands oil is a whole different animal than traditional crude oil that we're used to dealing with. And they're still trying to figure out what to deal with it.
Yeah, and this is the way the oil is extracted is very different from what people think of. You sort of have a, you know, an oil well and it just pumps liquid crude out of there. With tar sands, it has to be separated from the tar sands or in some cases from shale through a process of steam heating, essentially, to leach it out. And what comes out is not what you think of as oil. It's not what you pour into your engine. What comes out is this sort of tar. That's why it's called tar sands. It comes out as this very thick kind of tar-like goop, which is so thick that it won't flow through the pipeline. So they have to put in what's called a diluent, which is another petroleum product, but much thinner to try to thin it out and make it viscous enough that it will flow through one of these pipelines. And as I recall, they didn't even know it was tar sands crude immediately after the oil spill. Like the MSDS sheets were for regular crude, right?
Well, what happened was that Enbridge didn't disclose that it was tar sands oil until about 10 days after. And that was after Eartha Jane Melzer. And you know, Eartha was our colleague at Michigan Messenger and did some phenomenal reporting on this as well. She found the U.S. Geological Survey results that showed that this oil, this Cold Lake crude, which is what they kept calling it, was actually tar sands oil. And when we confronted, I can't remember the guy's name now, the CEO, Pat Daniels, that's it, with that information, he finally admitted publicly that it was tar sands oil. But that was 10 days after the spill happened. And up until that point, they had been providing them with MSDS for general crude instead of the actual tar sands oil or the crude lake oil, which actually required a much larger evacuation, a mandatory evacuation, which never happened. There were a lot of things that got screwed up as a result of that. So what you had was a response by the EPA and by the state to a traditional crude oil spill, when in fact they had a ton of tar sands oil in the river, and it ended up contaminating 38 miles of the Kalamazoo River.
Yeah, and I thought they did a good job initially of containing it. I mean, it didn't hit Morro Lake, which was their real sort of stopgap point. They really wanted to make sure once it hit Morro Lake, it could spread a lot further because there was a dam there. And which Morro Lake is really just a wide spot in the Kalamazoo River.
Correct.
Initially I thought with all the booms and all the work they did, I thought they did a pretty good job of keeping it from spreading too far downstream. But as you said, the problem then came in, they thought they essentially had most of the cleanup done. And then spring 2011, after things thaw out, all of a sudden this stuff starts bubbling up again.
Correct. That was part of the issue. But, you know, Ed, the National Transportation Safety Board a week ago released thousands of pages of documents as part of their investigation into this rupture. And it actually shows that the emergency response was not as adequate as we thought it was to begin with.
Really? Okay.
In fact, they had an opportunity to stop the spill from spreading as quickly as it was, but they didn't create the proper underflow dam. At one of the locations where Talmadge Creek went under one of the roads, they could have put basically plywood over that pipe that went under the road, and it would have stopped the oil from actually going under, because it would have forced the flow of the water under the board, but kept the oil stopped there at that location. And they didn't do that.
Interesting, and we should say that the oil actually flowed into Talmadge Creek, which is a much smaller tributary that flows into the Kalamazoo River. Of course, the Kalamazoo River was a much bigger concern once it hit there, that it could spread a lot further. But that's really interesting that they could have actually stopped the bulk of the oil from getting from Talmadge to the river.
Correct, and on top of that, the report also indicates that they did not have sufficient boom available to address the crisis right away, that they really only had about 6 or 7 booming sites set up within 48 hours, but they really needed to have 17 or 18 of them at that point.
And boom is essentially surface skimmers.
Well, boom is actually...
Or containment devices, at least.
Yeah, it's a containment thing. And what it's designed to do is to push the oil into a natural collection point on the river where it can be sucked up with vacuum cleaners, basically.
Right.
But what they found was, because of the BP explosion down in the Gulf, a lot of the assets that would normally be available were not available. In fact, the lead emergency responder was Garner Incorporated out of Texas, and it took them almost 3 days to mobilize a team to get up here to start addressing the crisis.
Because they were already involved, had all their resources down in the Gulf of Mexico. The BP oil spill was, what, a couple of months before that?
Correct. And they were still, I mean, it was still significant. They hadn't shut off the flow of the oil at that point.
Right.
So the oil was still gushing into the ocean, and there was a lot of cleanup still going on down there when this happened. And so a lot of boom ended up having to come from all over the country, from the northern part of the country, and long distances at that. There just was not adequate booming available.
That's interesting. I did not know that. But, you know, even, like I said, I think they managed to contain it to some degree in terms of how far it had spread, but what they were getting off the surface, because that oil is so thick and heavy, what they were skimming off the surface wasn't touching the stuff that had sunk to the bottom.
Correct.
And that started coming back up then a few months later, and they went, oh, no, we got a whole other cleanup to do here.
Well, that was part of it. The other part of it, too, is... remember that the river was at about 9-foot flood stage at the time that this rupture happened. So there was the flow of the river was such that the booming that was put out was also not adequate, because the strength of the river just pushed the oil right under the booms. That also added in allowing the oil to drop to the bottom of the river and collect as well, because you broke it up some.
Right.
So there were a lot of facts here that we didn't know at the time that we're learning now that really made this a much bigger disaster than it probably would have been, say, had we had normal rainfall at that point.
Yeah, some of it would just be circumstances, and then some of it was, the dishonesty of not telling us that it was tar sands, not telling certainly the EPA and the DNR that it was tar sands, because that requires, we should explain MSDS sheets as material safety data sheets, which is, I think that's what it stands for,
yes.
Which are essentially these sheets that say, for any sort of chemical that could hit the environment or anything that could be dangerous, they are provided that say, here's what you have to do if there's a leak. And as you said, tar sands oil is so different from conventional sweet crude that if your MSDS sheet says you're supposed to respond one way, but you've got a different substance than you thought you had, one that reacts very differently once it hits water, then you have to have a whole different strategy. And so for the first 10 days or so after this spill, they were essentially, using a strategy to attack one thing when they had another.
Absolutely. And that's part of the issue that's going on. And, just even backing it up further, we reported that there were hundreds of anomalies on Lakehead Pipeline 6B, which is the line that actually broke, and that Enbridge was aware of these for years and had been actually seeking permission to extend the time that they needed to fix those anomalies. And an anomaly means that an inline inspection tool, which is called a PIG, was put through the line, and the ultrasonic bounces indicated that there was something wrong with the pipe. Now, that could be something as simple as a basic little corrosion point, or as significant as a giant crack that wasn't very deep but was very long. And in this instance, what we have now found out based on released information is that Enbridge knew of 15 significant features at the location of the rupture. And based on the reading of an interview with one of the engineers from Enbridge, one of those features was a 51-inch crack, which ultimately became that 6.5 foot long, 4-inch wide rupture, the fishmouth rupture that we saw when they finally got the pipe out of the ground.
Yeah, and that's an incredible picture, which we published and has been published pretty widely, of the once they pulled the pipe out of there, after they got everything, shut down, then they called it a fishmouth rupture. That's exactly what it looks like. It's a pipe with a giant, massive hole in it, sort of shaped like the mouth of a fish, and the oil was just pouring through there. But one of the things that about this is not just that tar sands oil is more dangerous once it does leak into the environment, but that it also makes those spills more likely than if you had conventional sweet crude flowing
Absolutely.
Through the pipeline for a couple different ways. Explain how that is.
Well, first of all, it's got more corrosive chemical in it. It's got heavier sulfur in it, which can lead to sulfuric acid in the line, which obviously dissolves the metal as it goes by. But it's also, because it's thicker, it requires more pressures, and those pressures can impact anomalies on the line, such as cracks. In fact, one of the experts that I've spoken to in the last week, Richard Krupowicz from Accufax in Washington, says that this spill and the information that's now coming out about it really should be helping us to look at more effectively transitioning older pipelines into tar sands oil lines because of the potential impact for rupturing the line, because it changes the math. Basically,
yeah. And if you've got a crack starting to form in a pipeline, or some corrosion that's starting to wear down the metal, the fact that you have to use much higher pressure to push that tar sands oil through than you would for conventional crude is going to make those more likely to burst.
Correct.
And the other interesting thing I thought from our reporting on that was that it also, because of the thickness of it, sends off false pressure warnings in the control room, like hundreds of them a day.
Correct. And in fact, that's one of the other reports that came out from the NTSB shows that part of the problem with this spill was what was going on in the control room. And we wrote a lot about that issue, but there's even more information now. And one of the things they've pointed out factually is that the people in the control room did not have the experience that they needed to really have to be running these pipelines. And in fact, the person who was overseeing 6B was overseeing two other pipelines aside from 6B and had no experience. He was a mentor or a mentee. And the mentor was paying attention to a completely different line at the time that all of this happened.
Yeah, I remember his name was Carl something.
Carl Wermer.
And the Pipeline Safety Trust, and he had worked in these control rooms, and he said, listen, you get these false pressure readings, false pressure warnings, hundreds of times a day when you have tar sands flowing through there, which makes it almost impossible to distinguish a real pressure problem from a false one. And so you sort of start tuning them out. And the other thing is that because of that, the only way to really find out or to know whether that pressure warning is really indicative of a problem is once you actually see the oil or smell the oil. And that's why that pipeline continued to flow for, 11 hours after it was first reported?
Actually, what happened was is the rupture appears to have occurred on a Sunday night when they shut the line down. And they had a bunch of alarms that went off at that point when the system got shut down. And those were pressure alarms, and those were mass balance alarms that said, wait, there's a problem here. And they just attributed that to a shutdown error. And it was the next morning when they went to turn the line back on that they started getting all these alarms and errors. And so they kept turning it on and turning it off and turning it on and turning it off, which really, and they did that for hours, and it wasn't until 11 a.m., about 11:30, that they actually got a phone call that they had actually found oil on the ground. And at that point is when they shut down and isolated the leak. So they had millions of gallons of tar sands oil that had not been isolated, that was being not only leaking out when there wasn't any line run, but also when they kept turning it on and turning it off and turning it on and turning it off, which obviously pushes the pressure out to push more of that stuff out. And then when you stop it, it allows the pressure to continue letting it out. So there were a lot of errors from the control room because of those misreading of alarms.
And this is, the Lakehead Pipeline was built in the late 60s.
Correct. Into service in 1969.
Right. So it's not terribly old for a pipeline, but it's not the latest technology to be sure. But when you look at the TransCanada pipeline, TransCanada is the owner of the Keystone. Well, the Keystone XL is what's being debated right now. That's the part that would run, all the way down to Texas, through Cushing, Oklahoma. But Keystone 1 is already open. It opened about 2 years ago, and that comes down from Alberta and then straight across the northern part of the United States. And it comes down and feeds into the Whiting plant in Indiana, and I think probably the Marathon plant there in Detroit as well. But that one was just built 2 years ago, and TransCanada, in all of their filings with the EPA, promised that this was state-of-the-art technology. It didn't have the problems of the old pipelines. There wouldn't be any leaking. And yet it's leaked more than 30 times in the first 2 years. Leaks like we've had here, but if this is state-of-the-art technology, it hasn't gotten a lot better, has it?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the reality is that we've gotten better at coating the lines from the outside to protect them from corrosion that way, but we have not gotten very good at detecting leaks, which is part of the problem. And as you know, Enbridge had testified before Congress just days before this event and had said that they could detect a leak within seconds of it starting and they could shut it down, and that just clearly is not accurate or truthful anymore, and that has been proven over and over again. Part of the problem here, too, Ed, is that there's math formulas that are involved here. And those math formulas help the engineers make decisions about whether or not an anomaly is a real risk or is okay to continue operating the line with. The problem is that they all take into account certain assumptions. And if those assumptions are wrong, then your math formula is wrong. You know, if you assume that you've got three of one thing and two of another, so you're going to have five, that's great, unless, of course, you have one of the first thing and only one of the other, and then you have two instead of five. And that appears to be what happened in this incident with Enbridge as well, is that they miscalculated how long it would take for those cracks at the rupture point to become real risks.
You mentioned Eartha Melzer, who was, of course, our colleague at the Michigan Messenger for years, another terrific reporter, and she did a lot of work on this spill, too. One of the things that she did was started tracing where all the pipelines actually were.
Yeah.
And found that that same pipeline goes under the St. Clair River, St. Clair River or Detroit River?
Yeah, St. Clair River.
Okay. Which, you know, there's an awful lot of municipal water systems that get their water intake from that within a few miles of where that pipeline was. And then the other thing that she found was there's also one that goes underneath, essentially the Mackinac Bridge. It goes underneath, Lake Michigan and Lake Huron, where they come together north. I mean, if there's a leak in one of those, I mean, that's going to make the spill in Kalamazoo look like a walk in the park.
Exactly. And now, to be fair, Enbridge has fixed the crossing at the St. Clair River.
Yeah, there were some anomalies, and they were forced to speed up the process of fixing those there. I don't think there's ever been any anomaly detected, or I mean, there doesn't seem to be any problem with the one up north. But like I said, if it did, I mean, imagine what the impact of that would be.
Well, you know, and something else that's coming along that we're still pulling string on is Enbridge wants to replace the entire Lakehead line with a brand new pipeline that would actually double the amount of tar sands oil cruising through southern Michigan every day. It would end up, right now it's running about 260,000 barrels per day. If they get the new line, which would be a 40-inch wide pipeline, they'd be able to push 500,000 barrels per day through southern Michigan.
Wow. Well, I mean, at least you'd have new technology. You'd have better, probably a better pipeline, you know, safer than what you've got. But then I would think changing over also creates some problems.
Well, it does. And you know, there's some real concerns here. And part of the way they're going about this is because they're replacing it segment by segment, they don't have to go to PHMSA, which is the Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration, to get approval for it, as they would if they actually said, yes, we're going to replace the whole line. So instead, they're going through the state, and they're not providing the state with all the information that they have about their leaks, about their problems in their line, their current line. Any of that information is sort of being withheld from the Michigan Public Service Commission. And, of course, the Michigan Public Service Commission doesn't have the kind of experience that PHMSA does in addressing these pipelines. So they don't know what questions to ask. So there's some games being played at this point along the route in terms of replacing the line.
Ah, that's really interesting. Well, let's get off tar sands here for a moment. Another story that you've written about recently is the election of Dave Ajima to the Republican National Committee.
Good old Dave.
From Michigan, yeah, our old friend. which I guess I'm seeing this as sort of the last nail in the coffin, the final victory for the far right in taking control of the Michigan GOP. Is that sort of how you see it too?
Oh, absolutely. And I think Dave is an absolute example of the extremists of the Republican Party that you can get. He is anti-gay. Well, let me rephrase it. He is anti anything that isn't straight male Christian. Anything else is horrible. I mean, this man has introduced legislation and supported legislation that attacks anybody and everybody who's not a straight male Christian in Michigan.
Yeah, he's very, very far to the right. He's replacing Saul Anuzis, who was sort of a more mainstream business Republican, as Michigan's representative, one of Michigan's representatives on the Republican National Committee. And then Holly Hughes, I think, also was replaced by Terry Lynn Land.
She was. And I think there are a couple of things playing here that I think are important to be aware of. Saul was booted out basically by this convention as being too liberal. Now, Saul Anuzis is a lot of things, but liberal is not one of them.
No.
and what I think this indicates is just how far to the right the Tea Party movement has gone. And the Tea Party movement really was the energizing movement that made this happen at the convention. And I think we need to keep that in mind as we look at this.
Well, I think we're seeing that play out all over the country. I mean, you look at the challenge to, like, Orrin Hatch in Utah. And I go, you know what, if Orrin Hatch is not conservative enough for you, you're in la-la land. If that guy, if you think that guy's a liberal, for crying out loud, you couldn't see sanity from Sarah Palin's house.
Well, yeah. And that's the thing, Ed, is that we've already seen the Tea Party conservatives in Michigan rally behind and endorse Gary Glenn for the Senate race over Pete Hoekstra because Pete Hoekstra isn't conservative enough for them.
And again, if Pete Hoekstra is not conservative enough for you, wow. Of course, he's recently been all over the place because he suggested he's running against Senator Debbie Stabenow. He was running in the primary against Gary Glenn and Clark Durant and a couple of others. I think it's almost certain to be Hoekstra that ends up winning that. But recently he's been all over the place because he suggested that we create a federal agency.
The birther agency.
To check out every candidate's birth certificates. And what cracks me up about it was you see him on CNN yesterday or the day before claiming that, oh, this has nothing to do with Obama. What do you mean? Well, yeah, why would you think that? You know?
And I loved his defense about, well, this shouldn't be about Obama. We should just have this three-person agency in place, and then we don't ever have to have this conversation again, and we can focus our politics and our political discourse on the real issues. I mean, that was his statement on CNN, and I listened to that, and I was just like, you know, this is like going through the looking glass.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the stuff that comes out of his mouth is just bizarre, and I mean, this is the guy that put out, I mean, let's be real honest, that ad that he put out during the Super Bowl was probably one of the most racist ads that we've seen in Michigan in quite a while.
Yeah.
And for those who haven't seen it, it was a young woman, an Asian woman, on a bike in a rice paddy talking in a really bad Chinese accent, thanking Debbie Stabenow, although they call her Debbie Stab You Now. For sending,
I thought it was Spend It Now.
Oh, Spend It Now. You're right.
Yeah,
sorry.
Spend It Now. Yeah.
Stab It Now is what they call her when they're all in meetings. I apologize. but it's thanking her for sending jobs and money to China. And it was just roundly slammed by everybody and their brother and sister.
Yeah, including a lot of his fellow Republicans said, come on, this is over the line.
And he actually took a huge hit in fundraising after that ad. And he spent a lot of money to put that ad on the Super Bowl.
Yep.
So yep. It'll be interesting. I mean, Ed and I disagree on who's going to win at Republican primary. I honestly think that the Tea Party folks have a lot more energy and a lot more gumption than a lot of people give them credit for. And I would not be surprised if Gary Glenn wins that race.
See, now you're just going to make me depressed. I mean, this is sort of like, do you want to be shot or hung? But I would say this. I think Hoekstra has a better chance in the general election.
Oh, I think he does have
a better chance. Than Glenda. Gary Glenn is the chairman of the American Family Association of Michigan, or president of it.
Correct.
And again, really hardcore religious writer, virulently anti-gay. Seems to be about the only issue he really cares about is getting the gay people.
Well, no, he actually touted himself as the right to life candidate as well, because he answered the Planned Parenthood survey and told them that not only doesn't he support them, but that he would work to defund Planned Parenthood.
Sure.
So he is truly the religious rights dream candidate.
Yeah. God's guns and gays, right?
Yeah. And he's very much about right to work, which is a ridiculous name, by the way. Because it's not really about right to work. It's about right to not be in a union.
Right to work for less pay, basically.
Yeah, exactly. but he's very much in favor of that. And I've seen him in action, Ed, and I'm telling you, he's a very good public candidate. He's a good debater. And frankly, the two times that I've seen him debate Pete Hoekstra, he's just put Pete in the trash can and walked away.
Well, look, let's face it. Pete Hoekstra is not very bright. He really isn't.
Okay, I'll give you that.
Yeah. I mean, this is the guy who has sort of trained himself to sound almost reasonable. But if you put him on the spot, he has a tendency to babble pretty badly. I think I must have told you the story about this when I was on Tim Skubick's show, and one of Hoekstra's staffers was there, because they were taping two shows at the same time, back to back, and the first one had Pete Hoekstra on there. It was when he was announcing his run for governor.
Okay.
And then the second show was one that I was going to be on, and so we sort of sat back in the green room, which is really just a part of the room, it sort of toward the back. You've been in there. And we were watching it, and one of his staffers was sitting in there with me, and we were watching the taping of Hoekstra's interview on TV, and he kept sort of rolling his eyes and looking frustrated. And so at one point I said, you don't seem too happy about your boss's performance here. And he just kind of got this exasperated look at his face, and he said, are we off the record? And this isn't the first time I've had a conversation like this with a staffer. If you get them away, sometimes you will get sort of the honest, the frustration that they feel. And sometimes, you know, they understand that they're sort of propping up an idiot.
Yes.
And that was sort of what he said to me. And particularly he said, you know, the problem is he gets these statements in his head. He hears somebody say something and then he starts repeating it. And he'll repeat it in every interview. And the line, as I recall, the line that he was frustrated with was that Hoekstra kept saying in interviews something like, if wind energy was the key to energy independence, then the Netherlands would rule the world or something like that, which is a really stupid line.
It's a ridiculous line.
Yeah. as if, you know, the Netherlands is still all filled with windmills that, you know, as if we never went beyond Hans Christian Andersen, apparently. But
well, you know, Pete is from Holland.
That's true. So yeah.
But not from Michigan either. He's actually originally from Holland.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
But he just sort of was, I think and like I said, I've had conversations like that with staffers for other politicians who sort of, you know, they have to do their job, but they realize that they're sort of propping up someone who's really not all that bright, and I think Hoekstra is one of those people that,
I did that story about Pete Hoekstra and his ties to the family, which is the shadowy right-wing uber-Christian movement, that has some real shadowy connections to controls of government.
Right. The C Street house and all of that. Yeah. Yeah.
And Pete, was very open about his relationship with the family and praying with them and spending time there and whatnot. And his staff, the first time I talked to him about it, his staff didn't realize what I was talking to him about. But the second time when I went to go ask him some follow-up questions, they tried to sneak him out the back to prevent him from talking to me. And I caught him in the front yard, and he was willing to talk to me. He actually waved the staff off, and you could see the staff going, oh, God.
Yeah, whoops, he's going to say something we don't want him to say, yeah.
So, and at that point, he acknowledged everything. So, you know, I mean, Pete is not the brightest crayon in the box, shall we say.
So we have 7 or 8, 10, maybe 10 minutes left. I wanted to at least get into some of the subjects that you spend most of your time working on are LGBT and HIV issues.
That's sort of
where you've made your biggest mark as a reporter, and particularly around HIV issues and privacy. There's some stories around that you've been working on for a long time and some new developments. What's going on there?
Correct. We've been working on a series of stories related to the information that the state keeps about people who are HIV positive. And what we have since found out is the state is actually keeping information on every person who has ever tested confidentially for HIV. Now, there's two forms of testing for HIV. One is anonymous, which is where you give them a fake name and they give you a code. And if you don't have that code, you don't get your results. The other is confidential, which is where they know your name, but they're not supposed to use it. What we found out is that the state is actually requiring local testing agencies to record those confidential test names and information into the state's HIV event system, where it can then be tracked down and pulled out and looked at. And that doesn't matter whether you test positive or negative. You're in that database if you've tested, which is, you know, raises some real privacy concerns. If you're a closeted gay man, do you really want somebody to have access to information about what your risk was for HIV? Well, they have it if you've tested confidentially. So we're working on pulling out some more about that story, and what we're finding is there's no there's no rules that prevent the state from using this information for anything.
And here again, there are so many sort of different issues surrounding this one issue when it comes to HIV and AIDS. I mean, access to medications for those who are HIV positive continues to be a serious problem, both here in Michigan and around the country, right?
Well, Michigan is actually done pretty good at making sure those who are positive have access to medication. What we are not doing very good at is making access to non-occupational post-exposure prophylaxis or pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is the use of the medications for people who've been exposed or may be exposed to the virus to prevent them from getting infected. And there's some pretty strong studies that support the use of those to do that. The state, however, refuses to make any money available to purchase those medications, which in the case of non-occupational post-exposure prophylaxis is about $1,000 for a 28-day course. And it's about 80% effective in preventing an infection if it started within 72 hours of an exposure. But the money's not there to pay for that. And if you're a low-income person who has been exposed to HIV, how are you supposed to get the money to prevent the infection, which is ultimately going to cost the state and the government and the health insurance companies over a half $1 million to take care of you once you're infected?
Yeah, and this is an area where your reporting has had a huge impact. I remember, you know, a couple of years ago you reported on the story of a guy who had been exposed or potentially exposed to HIV and went to a clinic or hospital and they didn't give him, it's called NPEP.
Yeah, NPEP.
Is the sort of the long term you've been using. NPEP is the acronym for it. And they didn't give him that, and then your investigation found that there were no state guidelines on it. The state Department of Community Health had not given instructions to doctors to make sure that when somebody comes in who's potentially been exposed to HIV, that they are prescribed those medications that will prevent them in most cases from actually getting the virus.
Exactly.
And then that led to, over the course of a few months anyway, eventually, because of the pressure that your reporting put on them, MDCH did finally issue regulations and or advice or whatever it's called, guidelines.
Issue
a guidance saying, you know, make sure you do this. Up until then, it was just kind of a crapshoot. If you went to the right hospital or right clinic or right doctor and they were up on the latest, you know, research, then they would know to prescribe those things. And if you went somewhere else, you might not get them. I mean, lives literally are on the line here.
Well, and, you know, it took a year and about 3 months for them to actually issue that new guidance, even though the new guidance was actually the guidance that had been written by the CDC in 2005, 5 years earlier, which, you know, welcome to government, that's how it works. But even since that's been issued, we are aware that many clinics, particularly rape clinics, still have not instituted NPEP as a standard for treatment for rape victims. And we are aware of a situation where a very young teenager was stranger raped on the streets in Southeast Michigan. And, because the local clinic that did his rape exam, which was done within hours of the rape, did not provide NPEP, that young man is now HIV positive.
Wow.
So there's a whole issue here still, and we're working on that. Because this was so traumatizing for this young man, and we still haven't reported this publicly yet, but we are working with the family to get them to feel comfortable in telling their story. The young man was 13.
Wow. And like you said, lives are on the line here.
Absolutely.
And it's also, as you mentioned, sort of penny wise and pound foolish that you can spend that $1,000 and make sure they have access to the medications, or you're going to get a lot more people who are HIV positive, and that's going to vastly increase the costs of their healthcare from that point on. Better to prevent it in the first place and spend the money up front on prevention than to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on treatment for the rest of their life.
And what we do know is that because of that reporting, Ingham County, which has the highest prevalency rate outside of Detroit, Ingham County on their own instituted their own NPEP and their own PrEP program so that people who want it and or need it can access those medications as a preventative measure. And that's been really effective in mid-Michigan.
And you also indicated to me earlier that there's some new stuff going on with the FDA in regard to home testing for HIV?
Yeah, they've now, an advisory panel has now voted unanimously to approve a home rapid test. And there's a lot of concern about that. I mean, testing positive for HIV is not the same as testing positive for diabetes. A diagnosis of HIV carries with it a whole ton of social stigma, as well as criminal liability here in the state of Michigan, as well as many other states in the country. And once you know your status, you become criminally liable. So having that home test, really, if you tested positive, the response, as somebody who tested positive, the emotional impact of getting that news is overwhelming. It is emotionally destructive. And I can't imagine getting that information by myself.
Yeah, much better, I would think, to have that diagnosis made in, you know, with your doctor, who can then provide you with referrals to social services, with medical information on what you have to do now, can get you on the right medications as quickly as possible. Whereas somebody who takes that test at home may be so depressed, and so overwhelmed by it that they might not go see a doctor at all, or for weeks, you know, until, you know, when they're sort of at their most crucial stage.
Or worse. I mean, again, I'm telling you from the experience, it's so emotionally overwhelming that that person may take their own life or attempt it.
Yeah, and I've, you know, and you are HIV positive, as you indicated. Yeah. So this is something you have some personal experience with. I do as well. I watched my uncle do this when he came down with AIDS in 1986. And yeah, he tried to kill himself several times. After that. So
this is not diabetes that we're talking about. As much as everybody would like to make us think that getting HIV is just like having diabetes, it's just not. And for us to pretend otherwise is just dangerous.
Well, but even in the case of diabetes, you shouldn't diagnose that at home.
Correct.
You should have that diagnosed at a doctor's office, who can then say, okay, here's the medications you need, here's the lifestyle changes you need to make, you know, here's all of the treatment options and all of the support that you need to handle and that and respond to it in a healthy manner.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just, we would never do diagnosis of cancer at home.
Right.
And that's really what we're doing. And I think it's just a really ridiculous process. It should stop, is really what it should do. And if you don't mind, I'd like to transition just a little bit, because I know that we're running short on some time, to some of the stuff that we found out about the Grand Rapids guy, and we're not going to use his name, but he was charged around Christmas for failing to disclose his HIV status, and there was a big hoopla about him being supposedly admitting to trying to infect hundreds of people with HIV through unprotected sex and needle sharing. And Michigan law only makes it a crime to have sex without disclosing a status, not to share a needle. So, but we have now found out that the first charge, which was filed against him on December 24th, actually may not have any standing, because he was charged for not disclosing during a sexual relationship between June and October of 2008. However, the state accidentally released information to me that shows that he didn't test positive until 2009.
Interesting.
And the state has not released that information to the prosecutors, to the county health department, or to the defense attorney. And they had no intention of releasing it at all, which raises a whole bunch of ethics questions.
Absolutely.
Since they knew 4 days after this guy was charged that the charge was bogus.
And I do a lot of writing on criminal justice issues, and that's always a problem. We see that a lot with withholding evidence that could exonerate somebody. It's usually done by prosecutors and police, not by community health, but the result is the same. You may have somebody, you know, getting criminally charged with something that they're not guilty of.
Well, and in this instance, it actually led to the guy being just demonized all over the internet. I mean, he's been called an AIDS monster and a serial murderer and all kinds of issues that really stemmed from the charges from December 24th and these lurid allegations that he supposedly admitted to having sex with hundreds of people and sharing needles with hundreds of people in an attempt to infect them.
Well, that's sad. And I'm sure you'll be publishing the story as soon as you get all the details wrapped up. Listen, nobody in the country is doing better reporting on these issues than you are when it comes to HIV and LGBT issues. And I'm, I, you know, I'm just proud of the work that you've done and proud to have been a part of helping, you know, get it out there over the last few years. So keep up the great work, and I'm sure we'll have you back on the show sometime, and it's been great talking to you.
Sure. Thank you, Ed. I appreciate the time.
And we are back with more with Don Reese. You know, I want to continue talking about this evolution and creationism thing, which, of course, I've been involved in for a long time in various ways. There's a new Men in Black movie out. I know you see a lot of movies while you're on the road. Have you seen it yet?
I did see that just last week.
Yeah, and I haven't seen it yet, and I probably won't until it comes out on HBO. But the World Net Daily, which is my favorite crazy website, has an article claiming that the movie proves that creationism is true.
Men in Black is your,
yeah, exactly.
That's your empirical evidence?
Apparently.
Men in Black, 3.
Yes.
Not even 1, 3.
Yeah, but the reasoning of this is really funny. Apparently in the movie there's this alien who has the ability to see into the future and see the results of like every action and mm-hmm. how it would turn out. And during the movie he supposedly explains how the Mets won the 1969 World Series. Because a woman at the baseball factory was having an affair, so she didn't notice an imperfect baseball that was then used in the game, and blah, blah, blah. So he says, look, you know, he uses it to argue that everything is designed because the odds are so astronomical that we would be here, just like the Mets winning the World Series was the result of all these unlikely events that don't seem connected and so forth. He doesn't understand, I think, the guy that was making this argument, again, Drew Zahn, doesn't understand the concept of randomness and contingency.
Right.
And it reminded me of a conversation I had with my dad once, a couple of years ago, when he just mentioned to me that around the time that he met my mom, he had gotten the opportunity to do some graduate studies at Harvard, and he decided not to do it. I don't remember why he decided not to do it. And he said sometimes he sort of looks back at it and regrets that he didn't do it, that would have been a really interesting experience. But then he said, but if I had done that, I wouldn't have married your mother and I wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have you and your brother and I love you very much and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, you know, of course that's true. But then if that had happened, you would almost certainly have gone on to marry someone else and you'd have other children and you'd love them just as much as you do us. And you'd have the same, you know, the same feeling. It would, you'd feel like that was destiny. You know, if that was the reality, he'd think about the possibility of this reality and think, boy, I guess it's good I didn't do that, you know. But the odds of either outcome are exactly the same. You know, in either case, you could look back on a million different things that had to happen mm-hmm. for that to happen. You know, if your great, great, great grandfather dies in childbirth or doesn't go to the ice cream social where he met his wife, then you and I aren't here. You know, but someone would be here and they would have just as many millions of unlikely events that led to them being there. It's not a miracle and it doesn't require that someone determine everything that happens. There's no destiny. There's just millions of events, each one of them contingent on millions of other events.
If I had gone to college when I got out of high school, I wouldn't have got the job. I wouldn't have met my wife. I don't think that's a grand plan. I'm just thinking it's an extremely fortunate accident.
Right.
That's why I look at it. I don't
but
think
the fact is, had you not made that choice, you might have met somebody else, and you might love them very much, and you might have gone on to have a successful career and be a perfectly happy person, or you might have been miserable. But none of this is fated. None of this is destiny. Nobody's controlling all of these things. So I better make sure that he doesn't step off the curb and get hit by that bus, because 14 generations down the line, I want to make sure so-and-so exists. You know, this doesn't work that way, you know. And it's just, the argument is so bad and being used, of course, just to prop up their religious beliefs. And that's the only reason why they believe it. And speaking of religious beliefs, now we've talked over the last couple of weeks about this rash of sort of right-wing ministers endorsing violence against gay people in their sermons. I don't know if you saw this week the video that came up and it was really making the rounds on the internet. That's really disturbing. There's a church in Indiana. And they had this little four-year-old kid come up and sing a song called Ain't No Homo Gonna Make It to Heaven. And the congregation goes nuts. I mean, like standing ovation, loudly cheering this kid. And I'd read that and I just, ugh. Just
start him young.
Sing.
I guess that's the lesson here.
And it just it makes me angry that they're teaching these kids to hate and then giving them positive reinforcement.
Exactly.
For expressing that. And my only thought was, imagine if that kid grows up to be gay.
Oh.
You know? I mean, imagine how quickly that cheering and applauding will become bullying and maybe even violence against him. You know?
No.
Because I know people who've been raised like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's, in fact, it's pretty common that somebody who's been raised in that kind of bigoted environment ends up being gay. It's not that unusual. Alan Keyes' daughter, Randall Terry's daughter, Phyllis Schlafly's son. This is not
unusual. I didn't know this about Phyllis Schlafly's son.
Yeah, she has a gay son.
I did not know that.
And so it's, you know, it's not that unusual for something like that to happen. And, you know, those people, what they are in for, you know, like I say, I know some of these people and it's tragic. Because they, you know, the self-loathing that they develop because they're just bombarded with these negative messages. It just, you know, I mean, I've talked before about how, in a global sense, I'm very hopeful about this. Clearly change is on the way. Clearly we are progressing very quickly on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then I see something like this and I go, oh, like I'm just depressed again, you know. Give me the positive again because I, you know, I don't want to think about this. But this stuff goes on, you know. So Mitt Romney officially sewed up the Republican nomination last week. The Texas primary gave him enough delegates to get the nomination. And now he's running around with Donald Trump, who...
Oh, good Lord.
He had a big fundraiser the other day in Vegas at Trump's casino. And Trump is still pushing the birther crap, the birth certificate stuff. And... you're trying to understand, what is Romney getting out of this? I mean, he raised some money at Trump's casino, a couple million dollars, I guess. But does he think someone's going to vote for him because Trump is endorsing him?
This is not going to pull in swing voters.
I don't know how. I mean, are there people?
I mean, that's all I can figure going after. Yeah. The base is just going to vote for him because he's a Republican. Even if they're not crazy about him, they're going to hold their nose and vote for Romney. But I just don't see anybody on the fence who's going to be persuaded when you take sides with Trump and this ridiculousness.
Boy, I hope not.
I hope
the fact that there are people out there who still think Trump is anything but a buffoon is again.
Oh, you have so much money. Do you need attention too? Really? If I had that hairdo, I'd be that guy you never have pictures of. That very reclusive millionaire.
I know it sort of sounds like an ad hominem, but that haircut alone, that toupee alone should kill your credibility on anything.
Oh, my God. It just shows that baldness is, there's no true cure. It's his money. If he can't get it, if that's the best he can do, there you go.
Well,
you understand why I shaved my head now.
Yeah, say you're a guy who did this, what, 25 years ago or so.
In 88, I did it.
Yeah, when you started going bald, you said, screw it, I'll just shave it off.
Yeah.
And you know, you look fine that way. I would look weird. I have a weirdly shapen head. So if I shave my head, I would, you know, people would think I was an alien or something. But yours looks good that way. But yeah, I always wonder about these people. I see this, you know, guys getting hair transplants. And look, I'm never going to lose my hair. I have very, very thick hair. Nobody in my family's ever lost their hair. So I don't have to worry about it. And maybe, I suppose hypothetically, I would change my mind or might feel differently about it if it were actually a possibility. I just can't imagine that. It would bother me. Like if I was losing, all right, I'm losing my hair. Big deal. Guys just sometimes just freak out about this. Like it's their manhood itself that's slipping.
You know? I didn't mind being bald. I hated going bald. The process does suck.
Yeah.
It's just find what you got left and try to make this, that's why I say in the act, but it's true. How do I arrange these four hairs on my head and not look like a child molester? That was my thing. I don't still want to be some creepy guy at the mall where every time I look your way, he's staring at it. He's going to follow us, you know. I'd just rather shave my head.
Don, I've got news for you, Don. Shaving it didn't change that fact. You're still the creepy guy at the mall.
I'm still the creepy guy at the mall.
In fact, it may be even creepier. But,
but they don't stare so much.
Ah, okay.
Before they'd stare. Now it's like, don't let them see you staring. They
so,
go crazy, those types.
Another federal court this week declared the Defense of Marriage Act unconstitutional. This time the First Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the law that says that neither the federal government nor other states have to recognize same-sex marriages that are legal in other states. And several courts have now said it's unconstitutional, but the Supreme Court has not yet ruled. on it. And I'm, you know, I'm a dedicated court watcher. So this is really interesting to me to watch. And a lot of people assume that any case involving marriage equality is going to lose because you have five conservatives and four liberals on the court. I'm not sure that's true. I think you have four pretty clear votes on both sides. But you have Justice Kennedy, as you very often have with the Supreme Court, right in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And Kennedy's got a really good track record when it comes to equality. The two biggest gay rights decisions the court has ever handed down, Johnson versus Texas, which overturned the state sodomy laws, and Romer versus Evans, which overturned a Colorado law that forbids cities to pass anti-discrimination ordinances that included sexual orientation, those were both written by Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And in the two big cases that the Supreme Court is likely to hear on this issue, the one that came down this week and then the case overturning Prop 8 in California that's gotten so much attention, the lower court judges were really smart in making their ruling in that they aimed it right at Kennedy. Like, they cited his opinions in previous cases over and over and over again,
mm-hmm.
clearly aiming it right at him, you know, like, we're citing your own argument, so you can't contradict yourself, basically. I think it's going to be really interesting to watch, and this will happen as early as, you know, next year, that we're going to see this. So I think this is going to be really interesting to watch. One of the last thing I sort of want to talk about was, I don't know if you saw this, a pastor in West Virginia died last week after being bitten by a rattlesnake. He was one of those snake handlers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he got bit.
Cyanide drinkers and the,
yeah.
the snake handlers.
He got bit during a service, and his own father died the same way in 1983. His father was a preacher who preached the same thing, and he died in 1983 also being bitten by a snake. Which, to me, like, why doesn't that ever cause people to question their faith? Like, his followers will probably almost certainly continue to believe the same thing, even though they watched it be contradicted,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they'll make excuses for it. You know?
True.
Well, his faith wasn't strong enough. Really? Because he was leading you. So if his isn't strong enough, whose is? You know, it just, I don't know, the jerk in me almost, this is sort of it's Schadenfreude again, you know. It's that there's a part of me that actually enjoys seeing stories like that. Just to see the stupidity debunked, you know. Well, listen, that's the end of our time. We got to take off here today. So we'll be back next week with more with Don Reese on Culture Wars Radio.